You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Milwaukee R&B singer Lex Allen will be performing at Summerfest on July 6th. We'll hear about the importance of his mother in his life and the evolution of his music. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Today is the deadline for the Wisconsin state budget, and legislators have yet to strike a deal. We'll get an update on that and other top news from the past week. Jonathan Anderson is a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Stevens Point. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, today is the state budget deadline. Where does it stand right now?
Indeed, it is the deadline, and that's a good question. The latest is that there is no budget yet because lawmakers still don't agree on how to fund state government.
And what are the main sticking points about those areas of disagreement?
Right. So really the biggest one is transportation, how to fund a shortfall in transportation funding. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and his fellow Assembly Republicans have said that the state should have revenue increases on a long-term basis to repair roads and to fund other transportation projects. But one of the hurdles in doing that is that Governor Walker has said that he opposes doing that. He said that he opposes raising gas taxes and vehicle fees, which are the two primary revenue streams for transportation, for the transportation budget. In fact, Walker has said that that he would even veto a gas tax increase if legislators pass one. And so because of that opposition, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and other Republican members of the Senate have said they also would not support an increase in either of those things, in the gas tax or the vehicle fees.
And so it seemed like there might be an area of agreement, maybe a saving grace to bring everyone together, which was a fee on heavy trucks. And that seemed like it was going to have legs for a while. Where is that today, though?
Right. You're right. However, that proposal turned out today to be dead. There was a block of five Republican state senators who earlier today said that they would oppose that idea. And that sort of concept was to, like you said, impose this per-mile fee on heavy trucks that caused the most severe damage on roads. It's an idea that other states have done. Kentucky, for example, charges something like two cents, roughly, per mile, a little more than that. And certainly, you know, Voss supports this fee, but it just wasn't able to garner enough support in the Senate.
So, Jonathan, does anything happen if this deadline is blown past?
Well, what will happen for now, at least, is that, you know, with the budget starting, the new budget starting tomorrow, funding for state government should remain at current levels until a new budget is passed.
Talking to Jonathan Anderson right now about the top stories out of Wisconsin in the last week. Jonathan's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin that's based in Stevens Point. And yesterday, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court ruled that the Appleton School District had violated the state's open meetings law. What's that case about?
Yeah, the court, in this case, unanimously, which is kind of amazing given the division on the court, unanimously ruled that the Appleton Area School District violated the Wisconsin Open Meetings Law, which is a law that requires, in part, that certain meetings of governmental bodies be publicly accessible, that citizens can attend them and you know, listen to them as they go on. And the case involved a school district committee that met behind closed doors to do curriculum review. Essentially, there was a parent group that had some concerns about a book that was being used in one of the classes, and they were opposed to certain references of suicide and sex used in the book, and they had asked for a new class. But the district decided not to do that. They just decided to review the book, and in the course of doing that, sort of convened this committee. What upset parents was that the district held meetings of this committee behind closed doors, and they couldn't observe them and listen to what was happening. And so a parent sued the school district in 2011, alleging that those meetings should have been made public. Yesterday, the Supreme Court agreed.
Interesting. So now that this is out there, what implications does this have, not only for committees that are formed by school boards, but for other committees with other government entities?
Right. So, I mean, there certainly is wider application to just school districts. I think, you know, fundamentally what was important in this case is that the court ruled that when there is a governmental body that sort of says we are going to authorize, you know, sort of a committee or some other sort of panel or group of people, and we're going to give those people power to take some sort of action, then whatever body was sort of delegated that authority is now subject to the open meetings law. And, yeah, that has application beyond school districts. It can also apply to units of state and local government.
And what kind of reaction did this ruling get?
It was certainly mixed. I mean, certainly the school district said that they weren't trying to violate the law and that they would comply with it, but Freedom of Information advocates unanimously, supported the ruling. They hailed it as you know, an important day for open government in Wisconsin. Even the attorney general said that it was an important victory.
And finally, Jonathan, a new national poll here shows that Wisconsin drivers are the fifth rudest in the nation, not the worst, but the fifth rudest in the nation. Can you tell us how the poll got there to that result?
Yeah, I don't know about that. What happened is that there was an online survey that asked drivers questions, what do they do when they encounter slow motorists, or how do they handle merging onto the highway, or how do they deal with tailgaters, things like that. And apparently, at least according to this survey, Wisconsin drivers are supposedly among the rudest in the nation. It found that drivers in Wisconsin were more likely than in any other state to steal a parking spot when somebody else was clearly waiting for it. And also that we're supposedly among the least likely to let somebody merge in front of us.
That seems kind of true. Just anecdotally. I don't know. Maybe I just had a bad week of driving. What else? What other behaviors are there?
Oh, well, there were at least, 10 questions, and it ranged widely among different kinds of driving behaviors. What I thought was interesting, though, is that Wisconsin got a D-, and, supposedly our neighboring states, like Minnesota, got a B-. Michigan got a B+. I was surprised that even Illinois got a C, and that includes Chicago.
Now that's interesting because, we have a reputation in Wisconsin for hating Illinois drivers. So does this mean it should be vice versa?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I would like to see what happens when Wisconsin drivers go down to Illinois and how they treat us.
Interesting. Well, hopefully, this was a small study. I think there were about 50 people surveyed in each state, I think it was. So it's not comprehensive, but hopefully we can turn it around on this 4th of July weekend. Jonathan, are you going to drive anywhere?
I'm not sure after reading the survey if I should venture out, but I probably will.
You will very courteously drive wherever you go and set a good example for the rest of us. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Jonathan Anderson, a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Stevens Point, and he was with us for our weekly look at the top news stories in the state. R&B singer Lex Allen is deeply rooted in his home city of Milwaukee. The personal experiences that he shares and his rich vocal stylings are gaining him wide appeal. He'll be performing at Summerfest at 8 o'clock on July 6th at the Johnson Controls World Soundstage. Central Time producers Halima Shah and Chris Molina sat down with Allen earlier this year.
I'm a message high. I don't do everything right. See, I'm losing a piece of myself because I'm wondering what everyone else thinks.
Lex Allen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, fabulous. I guess both of you are pretty fabulous.
Thanks. So, Lex, I wanna learn a little bit more about what it was like growing up in Milwaukee for you, and if that's influenced your music and your work.
It definitely has. So, born and raised here in Milwaukee. Grew up all over the city, so South Side, living in very like low socioeconomic areas. I grew up really fast.
What do you mean?
Well, I grew up really fast in a way that I was like, we knew how to catch the city bus all over by the age of 9. My mother always made sure to raise, like, she raised some really independent kids. And, like, you know, people always say, like, oh, money can't buy you happiness. Like, very true. Because we were poor, but we were just, like, so rich in family and so rich in care for each other and the knowing that the situation was only temporary, so.
What you're saying is kind of reminding me of your song, This Is Our Year, which sounds so, like, celebratory. Like, hey, we just did really well for ourselves. Does this have any connection to that feeling?
It's just like, because it's all changing. You have to be able to maneuver with life. And there's Mel Robbins. She is a motivational speaker. And I came across her TED Talk, and listening to this, like, kind of blew my mind on and stopped me from limiting myself. So she has this rule. Y'all ready for this?
Mm-hmm. We're
okay.
Ready for you.
Ready, Chris?
I'm
for
ready
some
for
hashtag
it.
Real
you
know, talk. Man. Yeah.
Hashtag real, right. So it's called, she has this called a 5-second rule. And she says, in 5 seconds, if you have the urge to, like, talk to, you see a stranger on the street and, like, you feel inclined to talk to them, she was like, you act in 5 seconds. Be like, oh, hello, introduce yourself, because those experiences will often, like, lead to unexpected, like, relationships. And even with, like, ideas, like, oh, man, like, that'd be so dope. And then we, you know how we just, like, stop ourselves, like, no, that's kind of dumb. That's stupid. Like, well, you like this? Like, I don't know, blah, blah. She helps you blow through all that in five. She's like, 5 seconds, write it down. You know, 5 seconds, introduce yourself. You know, get those engines revving.
Don't stop.
Take me.
This is our year, this is our year. This is our year, this is our year. This is our year, and no one can take that away.
Well, I mean, talking about new experiences, it seems like your music has evolved and it's taking on a new direction, especially with how personal it seems to be getting. And maybe that's what you're talking about here. In your video for Cream and Sugar, you show yourself kind of waking up in the morning and wearing makeup and wearing high heels. I mean, what was it like to share that part of yourself with people?
Oh, God. It was probably one of the most freeing experiences to be able to be around all my friends, too, who express themselves on a daily basis. And it was being around them, actually, that just like, well, why don't I just completely show myself, you know? And walking in high heels is not easy. Halima. Mm-hmm. So I was like,
I still don't do it. Oh, I've already God. Broken an ankle. I'm not doing it anymore.
And dancing too. My legs never felt better than the next day. But yeah, you have to be able to express yourself freely. I feel like that's the only way people can see that it's okay to be themselves. If you take that first step, because I have a lot of LGBT brothers and sisters, like in my family, I come from a family of 11. So I have like people around me who support that. Or just like be yourself. Like we always knew that you were like hella creative. Like I would take my mom's curtains as a kid and I would like make like designs and stuff, and I would put on shows in our living room, and I would make routines like Spice Girl routines with my sisters and brothers. And I was just like, no, I'm Scary Spice today. Okay, you can be Ginger. You messed up. You're Ginger today. You're Ginger right now.
Sugar, honey, iced tea. You are everything that's
It sounds like some of the people who are really influential in your life in that way is the creative group that you're part of, New Age Narcissism. What are the different talents that come under New Age Narcissism and the different skill sets there?
Oh, gosh. Producers, songwriters, choreographers, videographers, photographers. There's everything you need in-house, and it works so beautifully. Because everyone is themselves, and I think that's the beauty of it. So it allows creative freedom, because no idea is shot down, and no idea is like, oh, this is the best thing ever. It's very open and honest, creative expression.
Mm-hmm.
That is why I feel I was able to wear stilettos on a table and dance around my friends. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to wear crop tops all summer. Okay, go ahead and do that. You know, it definitely helped me find myself, if you will, because mm-hmm. you're around people who are finding themselves too, and in such a beautiful way, artistically, personally, being able to completely express myself and having that backing and having that brotherhood, sisterhood, helps you unlock, like I say, unlock those little passageways in yourself. And they definitely did that. Much respect to all of them.
If you could put words on it, how would you describe the version of yourself that came out in Cream and Sugar?
It is very Ricky Sparkle. That's my alter ego. My alter ego. Animated, like happy, just, I can just put it into words, like supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. That is it.
Honey, go and fill up my cup. Hey, go and fill up my cup. You're my cream.
You talk a lot about people who care about you, and I want to talk about your mom, who recently passed away,
mm-hmm.
And you wrote the song Mama's Boy, which was inspired by her. Can you talk about that song?
Oh, man. Pamela Renee, she's the best lady in the world. It was one of the hardest studio experiences I've ever had in my life. I was out in L.A. At the Howard Benson Studios, and it was one of the most vulnerable experiences I've ever had in my life, because I was bawling my eyes out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, letting go of that was hard, because you know, you don't want to. Excuse me.
No, take your time.
I miss you always worrying about me, reminding me my phone bill ain't free. I miss the payments just so you would call me, to hear your voice like a phoenix from the ashes. You carried me home in your eyes. I could do no wrong.
Like letting it go. It just felt like, oh, shiitake mushrooms. It was like letting it go.
That was smooth. I like that.
Like letting it go just like felt like it was like real, that she wasn't here anymore.
Yeah.
But I feel it every day.
Yeah.
But yeah, she was definitely like one of the biggest motivators. And not just to me. Like there are people coming up to me on the street like, your mom, like I couldn't pay like my rent on time and she gave me $100. And like, I'm just like, what? I'm like, you know, but that was my mother,
mm-hmm.
you know, like she was the mother to all. Like, you know, I would have friends whose parents like would kick them out of their house for being gay. And like they stayed with us. You know, my best friend stayed with us for 6 months. And she was just that person to not judge. And that's where I learned it from, like to not judge a person. A person, every person just needs that one person to like show them and help them unlock something. And she was that person for many. And I respect her beyond. Beyond this world.
I'll always be a mama's boy. I'll always be a mama's boy. You're the one I'm singing for. I'll always be a mama's boy.
Well, Lex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me. Halima and Chris.
That was beautiful.
Okay, now I'm going to dial up my voicemail message.
That is really funny. You're the second person. They're like, I want you to do my voicemail. Like,
you can make a small business out of this, Lex.
And now the next part of my career begins. Voicemails.
All right.
Oh, my God.
Well,
yes.
Lex, thanks for coming into the studio.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Central Time producers Halima Shah and Chris Molina spoke with Milwaukee-based R&B artist Lex Allen earlier this year. He'll be performing at Summerfest at 8 p.m. on July 6th on the Johnson Controls World Soundstage. on June 14, the man carrying a shotgun opened fire on a group of Republican lawmakers and aides practicing ahead of the annual congressional baseball game. Five people were injured, including House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, who's still recovering. The gunman was a 66-year-old who had been an open supporter of left-wing causes and had volunteered for Senator Bernie Sanders while he ran for president. The gunman later died after being shot. The scope of the Second Amendment has been something that has long been debated by lawmakers and has been one of the most divisive issues in American politics. But our next guest says that there could be some middle ground between lawmakers when it comes to addressing shootings. Jeet here is with us now. He's a senior editor at The New Republic and recently wrote a piece about this topic. Jeet, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, what are your thoughts about the early reactions from lawmakers about the shooting on June 14th?
Sure. I think there's been so many shootings, and this is not even like the first sort of congressional shooting in recent years, right? But that people have sort of these kind of fixed responses. There's sort of like immediate things like, well, you can't politicize a shooting, that this is not an issue of guns, or on the other side saying that this is an issue of guns. Maybe useful to try to like sidestep some of the formulaic responses and like, you know, try to disentangle, you know, what exactly is happening with these shootings. And they do tend to follow certain common patterns.
So when you talk about disentangling what's really happening, what do you see really happening?
Well, okay, I think that there's a couple of commonalities with shooters. I think a lot of people pointed out that many of these events, you know, you could, whether you want to call it terrorism or not, sort of political violence, mass shootings, involve men, first of all, and men who have a history of domestic violence and are otherwise sort of like troubled individuals. And then these figures become sort of radicalized by movements of various sorts. And it could be anything. It could be sort of, you know, like white nationalist racist movements. It could be sort of jihadi Islamic extremism. This fellow was a sort of, you know, left-wing Democrat. So it's this combination of, troubled individual with sort of anger management issues combined with coming into contact with polarizing rhetoric on social media. And so I think some of those issues, you know, are potentially addressable. Like, I think, especially, like, you know, I mean, I think it's a, I mean, I myself, like, strongly support gun control, but I think that it's, like, you also have to look at the larger society. To have a combination of a society which is very Darwinistic and lets people fall through the cracks and doesn't address, like, you know, issues of violence and domestic abuse, and to also have a lot of guns freely available and a polarized political moment, like, that's usually, like, a toxic combination, you know?
So where do you think the points of intervention might be if you take that individual who might have some undiagnosed mental illness, who has exhibited domestic violence, as you talked about, who comes in contact with that rhetoric? Where in that trajectory, before you get to the point of violence, should there be an intervention ready to go?
Well, I mean, I certainly think, like, the much more money, you know, spent on mental health would be useful. I think people who do have domestic violence could get, like, much more treatment. I guess the sort of politically controversial point is, like, I think that there's a, you know, pretty, like, solid logical case that they should also be denied access to guns. And I think that, you know, that's where we kind of get into problems. And, I mean, I guess the other maybe point to watch out for is this whole issue of sort of, you know, radicalization. And I mean, I think that there's been a lot of work done, you know, in Europe with sort of Islamic communities, and to get people to, you know, like, be sort of sensitive and to watch out for that. And I mean, it's sort of interesting that, you know, there's even there a sort of policy failure, because police aren't always attentive to what community says. So I think in, you know, recent terrorist acts in England, the terrorist had been sort of pointed out to by community members, but there wasn't, like, maybe enough done to address that. But I mean, yeah, I think that So it seems like there's a whole several different points at which there could be prior intervention.
You mentioned you think there's a case to be made that if someone has mental illness that they shouldn't be able to get a gun. It's
I think sorry to clarify. I think for me it's like the issue of domestic violence or you know, like anger, having sort of a history of violence.
Okay, so not mental illness, but who has engaged in domestic violence.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that mental illness is a little bit of a red herring, at least. Like, I don't think there's necessarily, as I understand it, I'm not like, you know, like a sociologist, obviously, but I'm sort of, based on people I've talked to and what I've read, it's not necessarily like mental illness is the activating factor. It's more sort of issues of anger or being socially troubled or alienated.
The domestic violence aspect is one that has been written about a little bit, but not a lot. Can you tell us about some of the shooters and their experience with domestic violence?
Sure. I think like almost all of them have. I think the fellow in the most recent case had several instances involving both his daughter and girlfriends. I'm trying to think of like the other. There was a fellow who shot up the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado, and he had like a sort of like a history of violence. But I think that there's a pretty strong correlation, like in these events, including the sort of jihadi terrorist. The fellow. In Florida, who shot up the nightclub, he had sort of custody issues and had a history of violence with his wife as well.
We're talking to Jeet here right now, senior editor of The New Republic, talking about the case about how Congress might be able to find ground that they can agree upon to fight political violence. And Jeet, you were talking about the correlation between domestic violence and some of the recent shootings that we've seen. And why do you think that aspect of domestic violence hasn't been getting much of a focus in terms of a focal point for people to step in and say, well, maybe this is a flag we should zero in on? I mean, is there a reason you think that the media and others have overlooked that?
Yeah, I do think that there's a tendency to sort of like normalize domestic violence or not to see it as a problem. I mean, or to see it as like a private foible rather than, you know, something that has public issues. We sort of like still treated, you know, despite all the efforts and changes that have been made, it's still not treated with the same degree of seriousness. And so we don't quite make the connection. And I think also, you know, like, I think there is a tendency to want to kind of, like, you know, draw attention to the sort of flagrantly ideological aspects of these things, you know, to say, oh, well, the killer was a, you know, white supremacist or a left-wing radical or a jihadi, and, you know, like, not to, like, look at the sort of personal factors that went into the who they are.
Do you think that that's something that could change and that could be agreed upon by members of Congress?
Well, I think that the effort is worth making. Yeah, I think that I'm not sure about like the sort of the current Congress, but I think that the I do think that like I think that it's something that has a sort of broad sort of social interest, and like I think especially, you know, it's a way of like dealing with the issue of violence without getting into the sort of polarizing problems that we have with other kind of solutions.
Now, as you were getting at there before, domestic violence, it's an issue that largely, not totally by any means, but largely affects women and girls, and hence is sort of treated as more of a foible than as something more serious. Is that itself a hurdle in bringing that to consciousness, to political awareness?
Yeah, and I think that's like the chief hurdle, in fact, I think. I mean, in some ways, it's a different sort of political fight, in the sense that what you're trying to do is not, you know, go against a sort of preset enemy as in the gun control debate, but that actually makes people aware of it. But I mean, I do think that there's a history of like things that are sort of taken for granted and then become politicized or become aware of them as problems. I always think of like, you know, drinking and driving. Like, within our lifetime or, you know, our parents' lifetime, certainly in the 60s and 70s, you know, you could watch, like, TV shows and Dean Martin would be making jokes about drinking and driving. It was just treated as, you know, this kind of, like, hilarious thing. And then Mothers Against Drunk Driving, like, really brought it as, like, no, this is, like, a problem. And there are, like causes to it and there are patterns and there's, like, laws and ways we can, like, reduce it. And that's been done. So I think there are models for, like, making people aware of social problems.
We're talking with Jeet here right now from the New Republic, and he's with us today to talk about, among other things, the link between domestic violence and violence in the public sphere in terms of shootings, and also how Congress might be able to find common ground like that to come together to fight political violence. He wrote about that in the New Republic, and you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think? What kind of conversations should we be having in the country about these issues to come together from the different perspectives, in particular regarding guns? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. What do you think it would take for the domestic violence issue and its link to mass violence? What would it take to bring that to the fore? You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about how Congress might be able to reduce political violence and reach new common ground with Jeet here. He's a senior editor at the New Republic, and he recently wrote a piece on this following the shooting of a congressman at baseball practice. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Why do you think political polarization has gotten so bad in the United States? And what do you think we can do to combat violence from a bipartisan perspective? What about this domestic violence aspect that we're talking about? Call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's take our first caller now. We've got Willem on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hello. I think part of the problem is the political power of the money of the NRA, and that makes a certain number of politicians unwilling to address the issue of any kind of common sense gun control in this country. And I think the other issue is, I think, a fundamental misreading of the Second Amendment. Oftentimes it's said that conservatives are textualists and originalists when it comes to the Second or it comes to the Constitution. So if I could, I would like to read the Second Amendment. It's only one sentence.
Sure, go for it.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's not about what the NRA often whips up, like the people who occupied federal land, that the people need to be armed against an overreaching government. That's not what the Second Amendment says. It's about a well-regulated militia protecting a free state. And I think that the other thing is the NRA, I look at some of their publications, and they often have like a footprint on the Constitution, and then they're not willing to control any amount of regulation on weaponry, what kind of bullets, who can own them, and they're always citing the Second Amendment. I think this is a fundamental misreading of the Second Amendment.
Thanks for that call. And Jeet, what do you say to that comment?
Yeah, no, I mean, I also strongly support gun control, and I do think the Second Amendment is being applied in ways which, like, is very novel. Like, it wasn't the case that for most of American history it was seen in such extreme terms. I will say that I think that in some ways the polarization feeds into the gun issue as well. in the sense that the people who are very take the NRA point of view, it's not just that they care about guns, but they also see themselves as beleaguered in the same way that other conservative groups did. The NRA just did this kind of like ad, which was very frightening, of like saying, you know, like these terrible liberals and Hollywood elites, and they hate us. And the interesting thing was, like, there's almost nothing about guns in there. Like, I don't even know if there's like more than a sentence about guns. And it was really about the divide in America and how there are these terrible people out there. I think that the, well, so in some ways, it's like almost like a chicken and egg thing, like, right? There's a sort of polarization over guns, and then the more people argue about it, the more polarized they become. So it's very hard to see how you can move forward politically on that.
Well, and thank you for that call, and we'll go next to Greg in Baraboo. Greg, hi.
Hi. Well, I'd like to first point out to your guests that domestic violence is a huge problem, and there are currently laws against people who have been convicted of the misdemeanor of domestic violence from possessing weapons. And those laws have been on the books for a while now. In fact, it was retroactive. So somebody in the 1940s who may have been convicted of that, police officers, et cetera, were out of a job because they had that on the books. As far as the Second Amendment, the well-regulated militia is the people, and the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The reason it's the Second Amendment is because it helps enforce all the other amendments. The Battle of Concord wasn't because the British were coming to take their rifles or muskets. It was because they were coming to take their cannons.
Greg, thank you so much for your thoughts. I appreciate you calling. And Greg's got a couple of points there, Jeet, beginning with the input that he's saying that there are laws on the books already that accomplish what you're getting at there about domestic violence laws.
I don't think that they seem to be like sufficient, because in a lot of these cases, certainly in the Orlando case and in the Virginia case, the guns, these were men who had like a record of violence, and their guns were actually legally bought. It's not like that they were like criminals. So whatever laws there are don't seem sufficient. And then interpretation of the Second Amendment, you know, we'll just have to agree to like disagree. I mean, I would just point out that it is just historically the case that the most extreme interpretation is a novelty. That's not the interpretation that was seen by the courts for the 19th century or most of the 20th century.
Greg, thanks a lot for the call. And G, do you think that we'll end up seeing more politically motivated violence given the atmosphere that we live in, the political polarization? Is this something you think that we haven't figured out how to get a handle on from whatever perspective you're on right now?
Yeah, I'm very pessimistic about this. And I do think that, yeah, there are these kind of like larger sort of social forces. In some ways, one shouldn't be too pessimistic, because there are other ways in which America's crime problem is actually under control. I mean, there has been a long-term decline in murder in general, but there hasn't been a decline in mass shootings. Those keep going up, and so we kind of have to think that there's something that, so this is not something connected with ordinary criminality, which is in decline. There's something about sort of modern culture that creates individuals who are very easily radicalized by things they see in media, and then look to violence as a solution.
In our last couple of minutes here, let's talk a little bit more about mental illness as a factor alongside the domestic violence you were talking about. Does there need to be better care, maybe health care, mental health care provided for people in this country who are struggling with mental illness?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that would be a huge kind of factor, and it could be useful. As I said, it's a particular type of troubled individual. you know, the sort of one with a propensity towards violence. But I mean, having said that, I mean, like, sort of like mental illness itself is a big problem and deserves care. And I think that, you know, like a society that had a more, you know, sweeping effort at mental illness would also be one that would be more alert to, like, you know, individuals that are going off the rail and have violent tendencies.
Let's take one more quick call from Melissa from Racine. And Melissa, if you could be brief, please.
Very brief. I think one of the issues related to violence is, in order to know the scope of the problem and address it, you have to have data. And organizations that get federal money are prohibited from collecting gun violence data. And so I really think that we need to be able to do that in order to assess the scope of the problem.
Melissa, thank you so much for that call. And Jeet, in our last 30 seconds here, what do you say to that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, the NRA has actually prevented the Center for Disease Control and other organizations from collecting data, and that's a big problem. I mean, how can you solve a problem if you can't even gather information?
Melissa, thanks for that call. And Jeet, thank you to you for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, everybody. This is really nice.
That was Jeet Heer, senior editor at The New Republic, and he joined us today to talk about how lawmakers might be able to find middle grounds, points of intervention to come together and work at reducing political violence. He was looking there at aspects of domestic violence and also mental illness.